Got it. Okay. Sound good. Yeah, you're right. It makes no sense to me. What is bubbly? I thought we'd think it would be obvious. I've never cared for that term. before I backslid into K3. Sure. Oh, absolutely. That's fine. That's fine. Yeah. It. It's Stephen. Stephen. Or everyone else is Oh, thank you. First of all, thank you to all of you for inviting me, and thanks for that wonderful introduction. So now I'll disappoint everybody by revealing the truth, the actual truth. Brief biography. I was a fine arts major in college. I had a teacher advisor who said, why are you wasting your time with paint and canvas? Why don't you go learn some programming and you can do some interesting work with EAT at MIT. So I dropped out of college. I went to Control Data Institute. Some of you may remember this vocational school started up by Control Data Corporation. And I spent 10 months learning how to program in RPG and BAL. Captured my imagination. I took a job with National Science Foundation as a computer programmer / operator aboard an Antarctic research vessel. And spent 2 years in the Antarctic programming and babysitting an IBM 1130, a wonderful machine. And in the course of that employment, I learned APL. We had an APL interpreter, APL 1130. And that was fascinating. So, after that stint, I went back to college and spent some time, including several years as a graduate student at Princeton in the philosophy department, and then returned to programming. And was fortunate enough to secure an APL job with Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch in their Management Sciences /OR Operations Research Department. And again, that was a wonderful experience because it taught me something about business, which I didn't know anything about it, how businesses operate. And I had a wonderful advisor an alumnus of Institute for Advanced Studies, a colleague of Nash, actually. His name is Carl Heimowitz. And Carl, again, taught me the difference between theory and practice, something I needed to learn after 4 or 5 years in philosophy. And I made my living thereafter as an APL programmer until meeting Arthur Whitney at Morgan Stanley, where he had developed A+. And I worked with Arthur, got to know him, a significant event in my life since Arthur taught me how to look at programming, how to think about it, and of course Arthur has, apart from his incredible skills as an implementer and designer, he's tremendously fertile imagination. Arthur has insights into the nature of algorithms and programming languages that I think those insights are unique. His ideas about what you could throw away, what you didn't require. So coming from APL, especially APL 2 and Sharp APL, which seemed to me to represent the best solutions to the problems that APL 360, the limitations of APL 360, Arthur had this remarkable insight there were other ways to enhance the power of APL 360. So we talk about that some other time. I'm not even sure I'm the best person to talk about it. So then I became an itinerant K programmer. K. When Arthur left Morgan Stanley to form Atlantis Software to develop the first version of K, we stayed on at Morgan, and eventually joined him. A group of us joined him at UBS, where what we now know of as K3, or you know, the last version of that idiom, that dialect of K, was developed. And we had a 2 or 3 years at UBS where we had a captive audience. We had the entire American branch of UBS, CTO was David Weiss, the head of the fixed income was Joel Kaplan. And so we had a chance to not just develop the language, but a kind of a laboratory of like application opportunities. And that was fascinating. And that it was there that I wrote a, UBS used Sybase extensively. And as you know, the K3 doesn't have the database primitives, select and join and things like that. So my one of my tasks there was to develop the first version of what I guess KDB. But it wasn't KDB. It was an attempt to exactly duplicate SQL 92. And that was fun. So from there, after UBS, various jobs in finance industry, and now currently for the last 6 or 7 years, I've been working at 1010 Data, which is where we do basically big data applications for various domains. And so that's the biography. I hope that didn't take up too much time. Seems very prosaic to me. I mean, you know, of course, I lived it, so you know. It was a fellow from MIT who had been using computers to design sculpture. In fact, the first, it's really kind of interesting, when I went to Control Data Institute, which was, I think it's marvelous. I'm a huge fan of vocational schools and vocational training. I think for some people at all talent and intelligence levels, vocational school is just a wonderful thing where you go to learn a very narrow, well-defined set of skills, very practical set of skills. And so the teachers they hired at Control Data Institute were all professional programmers. Now remember, this is 1969. I mean, there weren't that many programmers around, and some of them were like veterans. We were introduced to wiring plug boards on card sorting machines. Terrific stuff. And the first language we learned was RPG. Do you remember RPG, Report Program Generator? It was designed to do very, it was, I don't want to say it was declarative language, but you wouldn't recognize it as an algorithmic programming language. So it was like a primitive kind of COBOL. And my first application in RPG was designing geometrical patterns for three-dimensional sculpture. It was great. It's probably the set the pattern for my life as a programmer. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Control Data Institute was, remember, it was a 10-month, 10 months, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. And so there were, the course consisted of RPG, COBOL, PL1, BAL, Snowball, on both IBM 360. It was a little 4K 360/20 machine on the premises, and then there was time sharing with CDC's 3300 and 6600 machines, which are very unusual, very fast machines for the time, very powerful. So it was a good kind of sampling, and of course, most of the people in the program were older and had come from other careers. There were secretaries, there were truck drivers, people who had kind of read the match, the advertisement on the back of the matchbook cover, learn computer programming. And they went on to COBOL, mainly I think COBOL jobs for firms like Prudential Insurance and so forth. So it was yeah, it's just. And when I was at sea, for National Science Foundation, it was a Fortran and 1130 assembler and APL. It was an APL application for doing satellite navigation. And wasn't that big. Not that big. It was an icebreaker. I guess not sure how many tons it was, but yeah, I think there were 60 scientists and maybe 80 or 90 a merchant crew running the boat. I could be off by some fraction, but yeah. Oh, sorry, go, I'm interrupted you, please. I don't know how you could keep walking after seeing APL. I mean, for me, it was the character set. It's so beautiful. APL is just beautiful. Stephen, you know what I'm talking about, right? It's a beautiful, I think a certain number of us, including Arthur Whitney, I won't have a APL character set envy. It's a lovely, lovely language. And I of course we're talking is it superficial? Are these superficial characteristics? What do you think? What do you think? Do you think the physical appearance, the physical beauty of the type of the font and the way operations connect up in, do you think that's superficial? Am I being shallow here? Should I be talking about the profound, nature of arrays and how they are tools of thought and all that? Oh, that's just a beautiful language. And that's what got me. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The combination of the interactivity, the what's the word? The way the well. The fact that a sequence of operations can express a single thought. We always mention that about APL. You're not breaking a thought up into multiple lines because the syntax forces you to do that. So you can write, and of course, this is a feature that is sometimes overused, often overused, especially by beginners who are impressed with the fact that you can write 200 characters in a row and it'll process along the way and give you the result you're looking for at the end. But that feature, what do we call that? The idea that you can express a single thought in a single syntactic object. I don't know what that. I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know if there is a term for it, but all of these features work together, I think, to make the languages so attractive. I think APL and J programmers are much more aware of this than K programmers. I think that there's a higher degree of sensitivity to these features in J and APL than in K. But that's just an impression. I think J programmers are required to have a more systematic understanding of the structure of the language, the different categories, as you say, in order to be good at it. K programmers can hack pretty, I'm not suggesting that we all do, but we can. So it isn't really necessary to understand I'm not actually sure. It's just an impression I have, because I don't write J. I don't speak J. And it's been years since I've done any APL. So. It doesn't. Well, there's a limited number of adverbs in K, right? There's only six. Over, scan, prior, each right, and each left. And each right and each left are kind of dispensable, although you wouldn't want to dispense with them. They're extremely useful. And you've only got three categories. You've got nouns, verbs, and adverbs. J has, I'm not even sure at this point how many other categories it has. I know it's conjunctions, which we don't have in K. And just it's a larger language, much larger language than K. They're verbs. Yeah, they're verbs, but of course, they are like dot, for example, has their monad is monadic dot, dyadic dot, and then there's a dot, a version of dot with three arguments and a version of dot with four arguments. And I think there may even be a fifth argument, but I can't remember. I never use it. So are they verbs? Well, you know, this is something, Stephen, you might want to address. The distinction between a verb and a function. My understanding is, and the way I use it, a verb is a syntactic concept. And a function is a semantic concept. So verbs represent functions. But there's a distinction, right? Is this, so do you want to elaborate on this, Stephen?
I have
nothing really to add to that, except it's always seemed pretty obvious to me that noun, verb, and adverb, as I say, are syntactic concepts. So A plus B as an expression has two nouns and a verb. But actually in K, this actually makes it, I think, more clear. I don't know if there's anything parallel to this in APL or J, but in K, if you want to pass, if you want to capture plus, you want to assign a name to it, you can say A gets plus. Or you can say A gets paren plus paren, and that nominalizes the verb, turns it into a function. You know, if you look at the type of paren plus paren in K3, it's seven, it's seven, which is the type of a lambda as well. So in Q, I think you can capture. Or K4, you can capture, you can nominalize adverbs as well, right? Paren slash paren is a. I don't know what the type. I can't remember what the type system is in Q, but so that seems pretty clear. I don't think there's a lot of confusion about that. Whether people We'll pick it up and use that distinction is a different question. That's true. Oh, I only have room in my head for one language at a time. So actually a couple of months ago, I tried to implement a Tableau system. I was talking about this earlier, a Tableau system in Q. And things just kept falling over. And I realized that and of course that my APL skills are incredibly rusty. I'm always amazed at people who are capable of keeping more than one language in their head at the same time and being fluent in more than one language. Maybe some of you are. It sounds like Connor, and you're a polyglot. Very impressive. I don't know how you do it. So let's see. Q, and I was a Q programmer for 6 or 7 years when I was at Millennium Partners, the hedge fund, and we used Q extensively. We didn't use K4 at all. Although you could obviously exit into K4. The decision at Millennium was we were going to use Q, and it's a good decision. What's the difference? K3 obviously lacks some really wonderful ideas that only appeared first in K4. Table data types, transparent dictionaries, you know, you could add dictionaries together. In K3, let's point out, in K3, there are ints, floats, symbols, characters. Okay, good. There are lambdas. There are dictionaries, but dictionaries are atomic. So you can bang a dictionary to get its domain. You can get its value by saying dictionary bracket bracket. So you can take a dictionary apart, operate on it, put it back together, which is sort of like enclose disclose in APL. And K programmers for years said, took it for granted that you could do that. And that's the way you had to deal with dictionaries. The atomicity of dictionaries was taken for granted. So in K4, when dictionaries became permeable, and it was, wow, this is fantastic. This is tremendously liberating. And it is. It's a wonderful idea. The idea that you could flip a dictionary to is that right? You can do that, right? Flip of a dictionary gives you a table, right? And we, I'm sorry, what? Right. Excuse me, man. I'm just like let my dog in. So that was wonderful. It was a wonderful idea that you could do that. And the fluidity of programming, the flow is a concept that I was looking for before. That program flow. People talk about this all the time. How programmers will enter a kind of mental space where ideas just flow. And Arthur talks about it a lot. So these features certainly contributed to increased flow, as does the table dictionary, that you're going to distinguish a dictionary of vectors or dictionary of lists from a table. And that was, and of course the fact that tables are lists, not dictionaries. So really, and so from my point of view, the K4 rationalized a whole set of ideas. I never saw them as limiting in K3, because of course when you work in a programming language, it's a kind of it's the it's the you become or at least some of us, you become ideologically blinded, and you know the limits of the language are the limits of our world, to quote the greatest programmer of the 20th century. So it was a revelation to encounter Q after years of working in K3. And the I'm trying to remember if this was a conversation that I had when Arthur was developing Q. I think it was Q. Yeah, it was Q. He was living in Florida, and I went to visit for a while. And we had a conversation on the beach where we were talking about dictionaries as mappings, as maps. So mapping, a domain of, I think in K4 he only allows symbols, right? You can't use anything but symbols for dictionaries. Am I right, Stephen? For the domain. Oh, is it generalized? I can't remember. So yeah, that so th so I think K4 or Q represents a significant conceptual and practical evolution from K3. Nevertheless. I think there are some rough edges in Q. And some of them have to do with the Q dialect, and some of them I think are intrinsic to K4, but I don't remember what they are. So in K3 is a smaller, tighter, more regular language, I believe. So the limitations. So I think once you remove the limitations on a concept, You're obligated, you incur an obligation to have that feature generalized, completely generalized. If there are arbitrary limitations, if you've got some, I'm being very schematic here, but if you introduce some feature and you don't, and you have, but there's a footnote, you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do this, right? Then you think, wait a minute. You haven't thought this all the way through. So it may be really useful, but you got to learn the limitations, which is why Q for Mortals is this thick and Don Orth's K3 reference manual is this thick. All right. Oh, right. It's a lot long. Well, yeah, and it has to be. It has to be. There's just a lot. It's a much bigger language. The two most frequent dog-eared sections in my copy of Q for Mortals are the page on types and the page on the functional forms for the various KDB operators like select and so forth. So those are really dog-eared because I can't remember that stuff. I think that's another important point that I'm sure, have you all seen the K3 reference card? The little accordion card that we developed at UBS? Stephen's gonna go grab it right now. So the entire language, you know, can be put on this little tiny reference card and it is complete. There's nothing missing. Yeah, there it is. So K programmers don't frequently, they don't consult any reference material, you know, reference manual, user manual. You learn the language, it's small enough, you get it all into your head and you use it. And I think that's great. And I think that's also true for a lot of Q programmers. What is that? Oh, actually, it's the K3 reference manual. Yes. I should. Yeah. Now, I think in subsequent versions of the language, like K9, Arthur has taken K3 as his model, and not K4. And yet, K9 is more general than the last iteration I've seen of K9, which is several months ago, more general than K4. So anyway, I guess when we're done with this discussion, I'm sure I'll think of like 8 different other things that have to do with the differences between the variants, the flavors of K. Those are the ones that strike me. And of course, K4 is a much more, K4, a lot of it has to do with the applications that people are writing. We at Millennium Partners, we did not use Q as a database language. We wrote a distributed P&L system. That was the primary application. And the data was not in, it didn't use the, I can't even remember the tools that people use in KDB Plus for HDB and so forth. We didn't have anything to do with that. So, and we wrote a GUI for this application. So, but that was really an idiosyncratic use of KDB Plus or of Q, I think. I don't know. I don't know what the, Stephen, you're in a much better position than I am to talk about the space, the application space for K4. I think it is. The so, and then so as a K programmer, I mean, my I think one of the most beautiful uses of an array language is John Scholl's Game of Life video on YouTube. And I can't tell you how many times I've watched it. And I watch it for, I just find it incredibly pleasurable to watch it. It's to me, it's the most perfect example of the use of array language, a language to solve a problem. It's like a short story, you know. Do you agree? And his work as the dynamic functionista, which is again in an area that greatly interests me, which is combinator theory, is miraculous. And I did my best to implement a functional programming language, which compiles into a into Curry combinators. And then I looked at his work and I said, okay, either or both of the following is true. John Scholes is much smarter than I am. An APL is much more expressive than K. So that was my impression. I still believe both of those propositions. So are you guys familiar with this work? Have you looked at it? It's magnificent. It's magnificent. It's just so wonderful. I haven't looked at it now in a couple of years. I don't know where it is on the Dialog website. He was working. This is when he was the dynamic functionista. Does this ring a bell for anybody? Adam, yes. Yeah. It not just the Game of Life video, but the code that John wrote on Combinator, functional languages and combinators. It's magnificent. Yes. Yes, exactly. And you know, this is not a an area of special expertise for me. It was a you know, I are you are you you guys must be familiar with this, that if you want to learn something in that's in any way related to. Sorry, if you're always looking for opportunities to learn by coding. So some people learn differently. They learn very abstractly. And I'm not one of those people. And I learn by, well, that's an NSL as kind of a record of things that I wanted to understand better. So I implemented them. And I'm not sure it didn't create, it did increase my understanding all that much, although it was very satisfying to do the implementation. And so, you know, for, I actually first I first learned something about curry combinators from a talk that Raymond Smullyan gave at a colloquium at Princeton when I was a student, in which he talked about, I mean, you're probably familiar with his analogy, the mockingbird. Yes, exactly. His birds and combinator birds, which is, you know, quintessentially Smullyan. So it's kind of playful and very profound. Way of understanding things. Really? Oh, I have to look at this. Sure. How does it work at them? Okay. Is it used in your experience? Do people exploit this combinator in their code, or is it relatively esoteric? I need to take a look at this. A thought occurred to me as you were talking. Is that how do you, if you this is especially true, I think, for our array languages. You have some operator, some that appears kind of mysterious. And are you drawn to finding uses for it in order to find out exactly what it does and what its limits are and how you can use it? And so, I mean, Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating, Stephen. When I listen to Adam talk so blithely about a commute operator, the K in limiting itself to single character operators forecloses on the possibility of having an expansion of primitives. You can't, you cannot fit any more primitive operations into this very limited space, very limited syntactic space. So I would love a commute operator, but there's no room for it in K. And there's no room for the kind of combinators that you describe. So K, especially K3, is a much smaller language with well-defined limits. Oh, sure, yeah. Sure you can. Oh, I see what you mean. You mean write them infix. Write them infix. Right, yes. Right. That's right. That's right. No. Well, yes, of course, yes, of course, it is, it's easy to write, but then, as you point out, you're coding. You're not using the primitives. And I meant that, it's one of the advantages of having this kind of unlimited space that the APL character set and any variations that, any kind of combinations of overstrikes can give you. It's a lot of power. It's a great deal of power. I was trying to think of how to complete that, but it certainly imposes a demand on the programmer. At least it would on me to say, I have to learn, I have to master it all. I have to learn this entire language in order to write good code. I would be terrified if I only understood a part of the language. I'd think, am I really doing this the best way? Is this the most efficient way to do it? And one rarely, I think, rarely feels that way in K. It often feels that you've got the best possible solution, or one that's closest to you, to the best possible solution. Here's an anecdote. I know you guys are not, well, Stephen, you'll, as a K programmer, you'll get this. This happened pretty early on at UBS in the development of K. Arthur, who was in the next office, came running into my office, and he said, "Look what I found!" And he found that you could define a lambda that consisted only of x, y, z, x, where x, y, and z were the default arguments to the function. So it was a triadic function, and x, y, z, x over turned out to be a way to write converging selection on a table, and at the same time, multi-column sorting on a table. So there's this function, x, y, z, x, and it does these two completely, or it seemed apparently totally different things. And I think that's one of the beauties of K, at any rate, that very short and simple functions or expressions. So I'm not expressing this well. One hopes that one will discover some unexpected property of the language, that some very small bit of code will do something entirely unexpected, but interesting and useful. And I think that's one thing. The other thing, and I've speculated about this, and I don't know exactly how to express it, but if you consider, I'll speak very loosely. If you consider all of the short, syntactically valid sequences in any of these Iverson languages, code sequences, so sequences of length 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, consider all the syntactically valid sequences. How much that I would expect that to be a very dense in that you'd find a lot of really useful and interesting functions in that set, supplied with correct arguments, of course. And I've often wondered how much was there waiting to be discovered, that that we don't, we wouldn't anticipate. We wouldn't say, oh, these five characters, given these arguments, will do this function that up till now I've been, writing much, having much writing a lot more code to do. So that's of interest to me. But that's it. Yes, exactly. 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 So perhaps the highly discredited Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which doesn't apply to natural languages, applies to programming languages in that it conditions the way we think and how we think. Well, maybe that is, yeah, that, I think that's largely true. But, oh wait, no. Could you say that again? You're thinking about what translinguistic concepts or translinguistic ideas? Just a it reminded me a friend of mine, Aaron Siegel, who teaches philosophy at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, is this semester he has a seminar on ineffability, which strikes me as something right up your alley. You know, the territory of meaning that goes, that's inexpressible. And as a Taoist, I'm sure Stephen is conversant with this idea. A tone is a are you by tone you mean a musical tone, Bob? Mm-hmm. And you know the and think of two composers, Scriabin and Messiaen, who were reported, you know, tones, notes, having color or being colored, and I don't experience that. That's not, you know, the mapping from one sensory domain to another. It's not. The relationship between musical tones and oh sure oh yeah 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 Absolutely. I didn't think of them as ideas or concepts, you know, not because I find the idea of an inexpressible concept to be a contradiction in terms. Concepts are intrinsically linguistic, or at least capable of linguistic language, you know, expressions, concepts, but there are other non-conceptual cognitive entities, I guess you'd call them, that feelings, for example. Feeling isn't a concept. But if it's conceptual, it's expressible. I don't know what it would mean to have an inexpressible concept. Well, that's interesting. That's a very interesting. I think this all goes quite beyond, although this is what array programmers think. Actually, Arthur Whitney used to say that our languages are so productive that we array programmers have lots of time to waste on other things. So... I like that. Only that martial arts allows one to forget for a moment, or more than a moment, about programming and philosophy, and you know, that's, I mean, as a very much an amateur, I mean, just not as the worst student in my class, I will say, I just forget about, you know, turn off the mind. Which is it's a good habit to get into, isn't it? It is a kind of flow. Oh, it's absolutely a kind of flow. Well, I think sparring and grappling, which I was terrible at. But that, yes, definitely, that's all about flow. All about flow. So flow is good. We like flow. We like flow as programmers. We like flow in all aspects of our lives. Whatever, you know, it's a very general concept where things just, you're just totally identified with the activity you're engaged in, and you disappear. You disappear. There's only the activity. You are the activity. So it leads me to wonder whether there's value in the opposite. Value in not achieving flow. And I think there probably is. I think that this is a very good insight. I like this a lot. And I think it does describe exactly right. Thank you. That's good. Okay. And it involves struggle and failure and all right, which are can't. That is, yes. Yeah, I keep saying that. Yes. I like this conversation. This is very good. Well, I'm so glad to have met, and of course I know Stephen, so glad to have met the three of you, and I hope we can continue to talk and engage and exchange ideas. That's about right. Yeah, that's right. Love to. Oh yeah, it's on my website. It's called Slack. It's Steve's Lazy Combinator K. Is that right? Steve's Lazy Combinator K. And it's an implementation of I can't remember who, what there's lots of stuff in that domain. There's Slack, there's a whole bunch of other stuff on Combinators. So you'll find it all there. And it's unfortunate in a way that it's all written in K3. Although I have a K3 interpreter for Windows and one for Mac if you're interested. You can get that from me. Wow. That's an interesting idea. That's a real interesting idea. This sounds like a very big project. Actually, are we going to stop recording? Because there were some things I wanted to say, but I don't want them recorded. Oh. It's a great pleasure for me. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed myself. VRA programming. Oh, thanks. It's great. Yes. Yeah. Right. Wonderful. I was going to suggest, because you singled me out for having a long history with the array languages. Someone who has had an equally long history and very interesting is Joel Kaplan, and as somebody that you might want to think about inviting as a guest. He has a video on YouTube, a lecture he gave a couple of years ago at 1010 Data, called A Personal History of APL, which is fascinating because Joel is a larger than life character. He's the man behind K and the man behind A plus. He's the guy who at Morgan Stanley hired Arthur Whitney to write A plus for their trading system. AP, when Joel ran APT, the Automated Program Trading Group, and made a lot of money. And he hired Arthur to write A plus, and then again brought him into UBS to develop K. So Joel has a fascinating history. He's a wonderfully interesting person, a very nice guy, and he's a Zen Buddhist. So, yeah, he's let's see, you can reach him. Is there a how do I? There must be a. Where's the alt key? Wait, I have a shift, an option, and a command. I'm on a Mac. Okay, option what? What do I press? That didn't do anything. Oh, wait, chat. Wait, oh, I got a chat button. Ah, okay. So I think you can reach him. Let me just, and you can mention me. I'm gonna just want to look up his email address. Ah, okay. Got it. So it's Yeah, Joel has retired. He's now on the board of of the company that purchased 1010 Data. 1010 Data was, I guess it's about 22 or 23 years old. And they have a presence. We have a presence in New York City, and I guess we have a couple other offices, but I've been working remotely almost from the beginning. And our offices were quite large, two floors, 666 Fifth Avenue, not Fifth Avenue, it was Fifth Avenue, Sixth Avenue, I don't even remember anymore. No, Park Avenue. It was right next to Grand Central Station. It was two floors, but they've since moved to smaller offices in I can't even remember, I think 28th Street Park. But I don't even know who goes in there anymore. No, I don't think the programming group does. Yes. Well, Joel's an Orthodox Jew and a Zen Buddhist. He would be a great guest. I'm trying to think of who else might be of interest to you. Something will occur to me. Ah, oh, yes. John is so interesting and so smart. He has a website. Are you familiar with it? There it is. Beyondloom.com. You can read all about his and watch videos of his chickens. Think he just that actually mentions them in the introduction to on his website. Yeah, John has a few pieces on that he published in Vector. And I know we talked about this, Bob. The idea of doing for recursion what APL does for arrays. So think of APL and the APLs as tiling the problem, tiling the problem space, so that you're looking for a set of primitives and a set of data types that allow you to solve a lot of problems without loops, without implicit, without explicit loops. And we know there are a set of recursion combinators, such as the ones that Manfred von Thun developed for JOI, the JOI programming language, which Adam, you might find very interesting if you're not already aware of it. Actually, you all might find it interesting. The JOI programming language. Did he implement JOI? I thought he, we've all implemented JOI because it's pretty simple. I wasn't aware that John implemented it. I have to take a look. So it would be nice to see some more work done on figuring out, well, Oh, this is great. It's great. No, yeah, there you go. That's it. That's it right there. That's wonderful. Yeah, this is really, this is very beautiful. This is really, really beautiful. I've really getting to know Manfred was quite a wonderful experience. And I think his joy language and the papers of his, I believe they're archived at the university in Australia where he worked, are terrific. They're just great papers on concatenative programming. Oh. Dan Papone is a really smart guy, and he's done some. His interests are for me, they're aspirational. You know, I mean, his knowledge of math and physics is significantly greater than mine. And I've learned a great deal from reading his work. And I think his implementation of SASL is very impressive. I think I can't remember. We had a brief exchange when I was working on Slack, and so anyway, yeah. Dan is a great guy to get to know. Learn a lot. It's a very small world, isn't it? Tiny. I think cult is a good term to describe the mindset of all of us. There is something cultish about it all, and so cults, you know, that far from being any kind of expert on the sociology of cults, but to the extent that they attract, the power of attraction, there's also the power of repulsion. You know, some people just react very negatively to, I don't want to join that cult. That's a cult. I don't want to join it. It's a way of, yeah. There's just not a nicer group of people that you'll. Yeah, you raised so many topics just in that one paragraph. Buy versus build, the use of alien technology, Frankenstein monster applications, things bolted together, impedance mismatch everywhere you turn, et cetera, et cetera. So that's those are all topics that are, we know them, and they're all worth exploring. Not to mention the fact that it's really interesting. It's just the whole duality of human life. You've got, you know, we talk about productivity and how you can do with fewer programmers working in smaller teams. And yet companies are concerned with turnover. They don't want to lose 20% of their, you know, of their programming staff in one day. So it's better to, you know, rely on technology where you've got hundreds of thousands of practitioners out there, and you can bring them in and put them in place, and, you know, delude yourself that they'll be productive in a week. There's all that, all those questions. And we all encounter them constantly. And something else we don't talk about, and this has been of great concern to me for practical concern, is how do you keep people from writing bad code? how do you do that? Yeah. Yep, sure, absolutely, absolutely. Small groups have fewer lines of communication, less dependencies, absolutely. We love that. We love that. And it's a kind of ideal working scale for work, ideal scale for work, but not. Oh, yeah, yeah, right, right. Yeah, these are interesting questions, and I don't think there's a. Yeah, I force myself to take adopt a perspective of that. That from our point of view is heterodox, you know, like, ideally, five people can do, team of five people can do this, but what are the disadvantages? What are the problems? Are there problems? You know, and what are they? I think you're absolutely right that empire building, feudal impulse, the idea of having 100 people working it for you rather than five. Oh, I think you're right. I think you're right. I mentioned my experience at Harker Brace Yovanovitch, which was my first programming position. On leaving graduate school, working for Carl Heimowitz in the OR department. And was he a poet? No. I don't think so. I mean, he's an operations research guy, classic operations research guy. And APL was his language of choice. APL time sharing was his language of choice because within Harker Brace, which was a kind of a high, like a colony organism, there were all these little companies inside of Harker Brace. And there was a big IT department. So this is like 1980, right? And people were, they wanted to get these projects done. They couldn't get them done through IT. You know, take them a year, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they would come to Carl, and Carl would have the two of us, who were the APL team, we would implement these things in a couple of days. So that was an, I mean, his perspective was extremely practical, one of the most practical people I've ever met. And he was drawn to APL because he saw it as an instrument for serving a business function, business opportunity. It's kind of odd to think of Carl as a poet, if you'd known him. Exactly. It's like let's not spend, you know, time in meetings talking about what we're going to do in the next quarter. Let's just go out and get it done. Yeah. I love talking with Joel Kaplan. That's for sure. He's the ultimate maker. Have fun. Yeah. Actually, yeah, it might be interesting to bring John Ernest back, or John Ernest talked with him about it, because he's done the actual coding of this. So, and you can talk about his chickens with him. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'll see you guys. Thank you so much once again. Right. Okay. Well, you and I can talk about how I'm going to get that to you. Okay. And I'm not going to do anything for a while. I'll wait till I hear from you. All right. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Right. Yeah. All right. See you guys.